This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini on this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best.
St. Louis Fed President Jim Bullard on rising oil prices.
This was a surprise, the OPEC decision, but whether it will have a lasting impact, I think, is an open question.
Cleveland's Fed President Loretta Mester on bank failures and credit tightening.
We don't know right now either the duration of those effects from what happened in March or how strong those effects will be.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on the criminal charges against former President Trump.
Everybody knows this is a weak case. Everybody knows this is political. Everybody knows this is not a real case.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
And we will be getting a whole bunch of big bank earnings this coming week.
Also, Denise, a CPI report on inflation and Fed minutes coming this Wednesday.
And had some economic data out last week on jobs and the economy. Well, that really triggered a whole new debate about interest rates and whether the Fed will hike or cut or both this year.
Now, Tiffany Wilding, North American economist and managing director at PIMCO, tells us history shows the Fed has probably hiked enough.
We think a modest recession this year is more likely than not. Obviously, the probability of that and even maybe more severe outcomes has increased. We think the Fed probably will be cutting rates by the end of this year.
Wilding isn't the only one saying a cut is in the offing.
Yeah, that's right, Ed. And the banking crisis is also a potential drag on the economy. Really a kind of force multiplier for rate hikes when you think about it, according to Randy Watts, chief investment strategist over at O'Neill Global Advisors.
That contraction of small business loans is going to have a big impact on the economy. That's just starting. Fed's aware of that. I think they're going to want to see how that plays out.
So the Fed definitely is watching very closely to see how that plays out.
And St. Louis Fed President Jim Bullard, well, he told us there really is some uncertainty hanging in the air right now, especially after OPEC Plus new production cut.
And Bullard among the big names we heard from on these key issues this past week.
And Bloomberg's Michael McKee sat down with Bullard. Let's take a listen.
As Roseanne Dana used to say on Saturday Night Live, it's always something. We were in the middle of a quote-unquote banking crisis, and now we've got another oil shock. Everybody waking up to headlines and say, maybe we go to $100. So as a Fed official, when you see that, how are you reacting?
Well, on the financial stress, I think, this is a post-Dodd-Frank world, and I do think that the reaction to the banking problems was swift and was appropriate, and both here in the U.S. and overseas. And so I think, the idea that there are macroprudential tools that you can use in that kind of situation to calm things down, that seems to have worked so far. You never know if there's further things happening. But if there are, we can react with macroprudential tools again. And then on the policy, the monetary policy side, we can still proceed to fight inflation and get inflation down during 2023 and 2024 back to target. So I think, this idea that you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You've got the macroprudential tools for financial stress, and you've got monetary policy to fight inflation. We can do both as long as the financial stress doesn't morph into something much larger. And so far, so good. But knock on wood, you're never sure what's going to be around the corner.
But does $100 oil, or the idea at least of this oil shock, complicate your job?
Yeah, well, of course, oil's always, the oil price is always important. I would have expected at somewhat higher oil prices anyway, with China coming back sooner than expected during the first half here of 2023, and with Europe skirting recession. So both of those, and strong data in the U.S., all of those are pretty bullish factors, I would say, for the oil market. This was a surprise, the OPEC decision, but whether it will have a lasting impact, I think, is an open question.
Now, you had already moved up your estimate of where the Fed funds rate needed to be to bring down inflation. You were talking an effective rate of around 5%. 5.6%. Does this change that calculation at all? And can you explain why you think we need to go that high to hit the terminal rate?
I think we'll need to get over 5%. The committee says that the median person on the committee says a little over 5%. I'm a little higher than that. I think inflation will be stickier. And, you know, I'd look mostly at the core measures of inflation, like PCE core inflation, or the Dallas Fed trim mean, which really hasn't come down very much at all. It's still in the 4% range, so, you know, 4.6 or something like that. So we're still talking about a lot of inflation, more than double our inflation target on that basis. And oil prices fluctuate around. It's hard to track exactly. Some of that might feed into inflation and make our job a little bit more difficult.
How concerned are you with all these headlines about layoffs coming in that you may go too far?
Yeah, the labor market is super strong. Still, many more job openings than there are unemployed workers. I think if a worker does get disrupted today, that they should, you know, let's hope and pray for them that they'll be able to get a new job. But it's still a very robust labor market.
Well, if they still need workers and supply is running below demand, that has to complicate the idea of monetary policy, because that's not what's supposed to happen when you're raising rates as much as you have.
That's true, although I'm not as oriented toward the Phillips curve as many, but I think the way I would state it is that the strong labor market gives us headroom to fight inflation. It's a good time to be fighting inflation and trying to get inflation back to target while the labor market is as strong as it is. And even workers that get disrupted, hopefully will be able to find a new job and maybe a better job in this situation.
You have critics around the country and certainly on Capitol Hill that say workers are finally getting their share. Wages are going up, not quite keeping up with inflation, but much better than they had been. And here comes the Fed, wants to squash them down again and cut the wage increases in order to bring down inflation. What do you say to those people?
Well, what are they talking about? Real wages have gone down for most people. So the inflation is hurting them. So inflation is hurting the average worker.
So you don't think the Fed has a perception problem with America these days?
You'd like to get rid of the inflation so that people can get their, get a better labor market outcome and be able to afford the goods that they have to purchase. So I think there's been a lot of confusion around this issue. It's true that some workers in some categories got more than the increase in wages that more than made up for inflation. But for many workers, that hasn't been the case. They've been lagging behind in real wages. And that's why you'd like to bring inflation under control and get a better outcome for the labor market.
Markets have been struggling to figure out what's going to happen going forward. Why are you and Wall Street so far apart in what you say is likely to happen?
They should listen to me. Here's what I think. I think I put 80% probability that the financial stress will decline, and then make that your baseline forecast. I think that's for low growth, but growth, a continued pretty strong labor market, and inflation coming down. That's got 80% probability. Maybe now I'd go to 85% probability or something. And then the other branch where financial stress gets worse, then we'll have to bring out more macroprudential tools, and it'll be a stressful situation, and all bets are off in that situation. The problem with Wall Street is they've got too much probability on that branch and not enough probability on the other branch. So I think they're going to reprice to the slow growth scenario, and so I think we'll see this change in the weeks ahead here.
Go back to the banks for a second. In February, the staff at the Open Market Committee presented on the idea of these asset mismatches on bank balance sheets. So you were kind of aware that this could be a problem. Was there something that the Fed missed or didn't do or should have done to keep these the bank situation, we'll call it, from developing as it has?
I can't talk about what was presented at the FOMC meeting. So I will neither confirm nor deny that. But my own staff here was certainly well aware of issues with banks. We talked to bankers all the time. We're a regulator of banks, and so we knew that there were issues about, let's say, some deposits running off to non-bank entities that wanted to pay a higher rate. That's occurring. But I think at a rate that's certainly manageable for at least for the banks that we talk to. They've got some securities holdings that have lost value as interest rates have gone up, but that also I think is manageable for nearly all institutions. So that, you know, they're running businesses and they've got challenges, but they've also they're also competitive, and they'll they figure out ways to manage the situation.
St. Louis Fed President Jim Bullard with Bloomberg's Global Economics and Policy Editor Michael McKee.
And coming up, Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester tells us the Fed might hike again and then keep interest rates elevated for a while. Or maybe not.
Yeah, you're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, a lot of doubts about what the Fed is doing.
Mm-hmm. And OPEC Plus, Ed, greasing the wheels of speculation about the Fed and interest rate hikes with that surprise production cut from the oil cartel.
Right, because rising oil prices make it harder for the Fed to fight inflation.
And Amrita Sen, chief oil analyst at Energy Aspect, says the OPEC Plus move means crude oil will surge to $100 a barrel even faster than she thought.
We were going to get $100 anyways. Now with these OPEC cuts, that could come earlier in potentially late Q2.
On the other hand, Ed Morse, global head of commodities research at Citigroup, says $100 a barrel for oil? Well, maybe, but...
I don't think we're anywhere near that yet. To get to $100 oil, we'd have to have significantly more oil taken out of the market and have a lot of uncertainty based on that oil taken out of the market.
And if Morse is right, Ed, that would make the Fed's job a little easier.
Yeah, right. And Loretta Mester, president of the Cleveland Fed, tells our Michael McKee, the Fed is sucking up just about every piece of data it can to stay on top of things.
There's just a lot of data coming in, and we're going to use that to assess not only where the economy has been, but where it's going. Because as you know, it's about where the economy's going that's really important for setting monetary policy.
How do you know what you're looking for when the data are in the rearview mirror?
Well, you know, the data in the rearview mirror is important because it tells you something about where the economy is going. So you don't throw that data away, but you also have to do a lot of other kind of reconnaissance. So, you know, the nice thing about having Federal Reserve banks across the country is that we can talk to contacts in our districts, you know, whether it be labor market contacts or business contacts, to really find out what's happening on the ground at the moment. And that information, anecdotal information, is very helpful as well. And then we do surveys and other kinds of more timely information. So all of that goes into sort of formulating monetary policy. So I think it's wrong to think like, oh, we're looking only in the rearview mirror at data that's from a month ago or 2 months ago. That data is actually helpful for looking at trends. And then we also augment that with other data about what's really happening on the ground, on Main Street, for businesses that have to cope with this economy.
Well, what's happening on Main Street?
Yeah.
It kind of two parts. In general, what are you hearing? And then what are you hearing from bankers in your district about credit quality?
Right. So credit quality is still fine. Bankers are telling us that that isn't really a problem. It might have ticked up a tad, but it certainly is still low, very low by historical standards. So that isn't a focus now. The bankers have, you know, struggled with retaining deposits during the March tensions in the banking industry, but that's has stabilized since then. In terms of credit standards, you know, they had already been tightening credit standards as interest rates went up. So they're continuing to do that. They're continuing to monitor, you know, their customers. They're continuing to monitor going forward in terms of making sure that they're well positioned for the economy with higher interest rates. In terms of the businesses themselves, of course, they are preparing, right, for I would say, some slowdown in the economy. But a lot of the firms are still telling us that their conditions are still pretty good. They're worried about the economy in general, and so they're being a little defensive now. Some pullback in some of their investment spending. But again, it doesn't feel like everyone thinks that we're going to have a deep recession. It's just they're trying to be more cautious so that they're well prepared for whatever happens in the economy in the future.
Well, the recession argument that a lot of people are making sort of depends on the idea that the full weight of all of the cumulative weight of your rate increases hasn't hit the economy yet. Plus, we throw in the banking, maybe tightening credit standards a little more. Are you worried about the second half of the year?
Well, I do think that growth this year is going to be well below trend. And you're right, the banking tensions certainly, typically when you see that happening, you do see banks pull back on their credit standards and tighten their credit standards. We don't know right now either the duration of those effects from what happened in March or how strong those effects will be. So we do expect that to happen, but right now we're in that time where we're assessing, talking to the bankers, looking at things like the SLOOS, which is the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, to get a really good sense of where bankers are. As I said, even before the March tensions in the industry, banking industry, you know, the banks were pulling back and tightening credit standards. And that's kind of normal. That's the normal flow of monetary policy tightening throughout the economy. That's one of the ways it gets pushed out into the economy. So that's fine. That's kind of what we are intending in terms of making sure that we can slow down demand so that we get a better balance between demand and supply and reduce those price pressures. And now we're assessing whether the tensions in the banking industry have augmented that. And that's part of what the evaluation will be as we go in to the next FOMC meeting in terms of calibrating monetary policy.
Well, you're in New York. All the big trading desks are only a few blocks away from us. And they're calibrating recession right now, and that you're going to be cutting rates. How do you process that view versus yours?
Well, you know, we've seen periods where the markets have one view of what's going to happen in the economy and the Fed has another view. And, you know, we certainly take information from that. You know, we see what they're doing and we're saying, okay, that's their view of what's happening. We have our own forecasts. We just put out forecasts at the last FOMC meeting. And if you look at those, we did say that growth this year was going to be very much below trend growth. And so I think we see things a little bit differently in terms of what the appropriate monetary policy is given where the economy is and where it's going. We certainly are focused on inflation and making sure that inflation gets back down to 2% over time.
Well, is the idea of 4 rate cuts in the next year crazy?
Well, it certainly isn't my policy path. I mean, I think we're going to have to go a little bit higher from where we are a little bit more and then hold there for some time in order to make sure that inflation is on that sustainable downward path to 2%. That doesn't mean we're going to continue to raise rates until inflation gets back to 2%. We're going to be sort of calibrating in order to see that inflation is going to move down. And my own forecast is that it will take some time to get inflation back down. But I think we're going to make some appreciable progress this year and then continue to make progress next year and then hit 2% in 2025.
What's your trajectory for inflation? Where can we end the year and how fast would we get there?
Yeah, so I'm about 3.75% by the end of this year, continued progress next year, maybe 2.75%, and then 2% in 2025. And I think that's a good progress. But you got to remember, we've been at high inflation, well over 2%, for quite some time. And that's why it's imperative that we continue to make progress and that we continue on this path. Now, we're going to be judicious about it. We're not going to, throw the baby out with the bathwater, as they say. We're going to make sure that we're making good judgments along the way. But it is crucial that we get inflation back down in a timely way to 2%.
Well, you said we should do a little more. The consensus median dot was 5.1, which would be one more rate move.
Right.
Are you in the group that was above that?
Yeah.
How far do you think
we
need to go?
I see a little more inflation pressures than the median in the SEP from the December SEP. So I probably am a little bit higher than the median dot. But again, I'm open to making sure that we're setting policy to get inflation back down to 2%. So I'm open in terms of let's take in what the economy is telling us about where it's going. Let's make sure that we get inflation on that sustainable downward path. So I'm not, you know, we've made a lot of progress and I'm willing to sort of let's take it in and look at where the economy is going.
And that was Loretta Mester, president of the Cleveland Fed, with Bloomberg's Michael McKee.
Coming up,
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on U.S. relations with Taiwan and also on the criminal charges against former President Trump.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York. Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C. Bloomberg 991. To Boston. Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco. Bloomberg 960. To the country. Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe. The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. And we've been talking a lot about inflation and volatility in financial markets. We'll be talking more about growth prospects for the economy in just a few minutes.
But Denise, we also have a lot of political volatility, as you well know.
That's right, with that historic arraignment in Manhattan and former President Trump pleading not guilty to counts of falsifying business records related to a hush money payment made in the final days of the 2016 election.
And these, of course, are the allegations from Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg.
Mr. Trump said that he was paying Mr. Cohen for fictitious legal services in 2017 to cover up actual crime committed the prior year.
Well, Trump, on the other hand, Ed, pleading not guilty to the charges Bragg is bringing, and the former president telling his supporters this is not about reality.
The only crime that I have committed is to fearlessly defend our nation from those who seek to destroy it.
Trump speaking there to supporters at his Mar-a-Lago resort.
And also House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Ed, well, he has now triggered a new round of drama with China over Taiwan.
And Denise, McCarthy and other congressional members met this week at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Southern California with Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen.
In the discussion with congressional leaders, I reiterated Taiwan's commitment to defending the peaceful status quo.
And Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern, Ed, she was also there covering this meeting between President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan and Speaker McCarthy.
And McCarthy talked to Anne-Marie about the charges against Trump and also told her the U.S. needs to take a clearer stand against China when it comes to Taiwan.
Here we are, the Reagan Library. Reagan produced the Six Assurances. And if you read through the Six Assurances, this is exactly what we should be doing. If we want to make sure that we foster democracy and peace and make sure we don't get into any type of conflict, people need to sit down. And what China needs to understand is they can't dictate who a Speaker of the House can meet with, maybe with foe or friend. For the same moment that Macron's sitting down with President Xi, I think that's great. I would sit down with President Xi. I think
is that a trip here, thinking Beijing?
I would gladly. I've been there three times. I think it's important that we meet together. And one of the things I think that America has failed upon is that we've never spoken with one voice when it comes to China. We've gone from administration to administration. So when I became Speaker, we created this select committee and had 146 Democrats vote for it. You've watched Democrats and Republicans here together. I think that would even foster a stronger relationship with China because China would understand where our boundaries are. They won't worry about, oh, one party saying something. You've watched in Congress this year, our only movement when we spoke about China, we spoke 100% of members of Congress voted for that resolution against the balloon.
It's the one area, really, of bipartisanship, I'd say.
Well, I think we're getting more, but
okay, well, that's, I guess,
you know, 83% of every bill we pass has been bipartisan. So
I want to ask you about what type of support there would be, though, if there was to be an invasion. If Beijing were to invade, you talked about arms sales here that need to get there quicker. But what would that look like? Just militarily, or would you send American lives?
See, this is a hypothetical question we would never want to get to. So what you're looking at, what we're doing today is, how do we make sure that question never comes to fruition? So what you would learn from Ukraine itself, because if we're looking back on Ukraine in 2015, when I went to the White House to advocate with President Biden, Biden to sell javelins. You want deterrent. You want them not to be able to come in. And that's the same thing we're talking now. In those six assurances, we provided that we would continue to fund weapons to Taiwan. But what we should do is speed up that process, that they can defend themselves so you don't have conflict, you don't have war, you communicate with one another. We build greater technology from sciences mm-hmm. to health with them. I think that fosters a safer world. We continue to advocate here at the Reagan Library democracy, freedom, peace, and that's what Taiwan has.
When it comes to Ukraine, though, there are some in your caucus, in the Republican Party, who are wavering. They don't want to send all this support. Where do you think those votes would be if it came to sending that type of support to Taipei?
Well, let me be really clear here. What we're founding in Ukraine is we want to see a path that we can win, not that you just send a check, but what we're watching that's happening in America today, it looks a lot like 1936. You're having from China to Russia to North Korea to Iran coming together like an axis of power. So as Americans, you want to be able to foster that nothing comes to an element of what we watched in the past that history has taught us. So no, I think in our party, you would find that we would fund so Ukraine would win. Because the same aspect would be that would probably deter any action in Taiwan. But what we can learn from the actions of Ukraine, don't wait till conflict happens. Be able to sell the weapons now so there is never conflict.
There's even a bill potentially of outlining what the sanctions would look like. Did Tsai Ing-wen invite you to Taiwan?
No, we didn't talk anything about that.
When are you planning to go? That's what everyone wants to know.
You know what? I just got on the job. I'm not even 100 days, so I don't have plans to go someplace else.
But you'd like to.
Look, I love the ability of one day maybe I could go, but what I'm looking at right now is the idea of building America's economy.
Another item on that to-do list you have is the debt ceiling.
Yes.
Right now, you and the White House are having this standoff. If President Joe Biden does not come to the table for these negotiations, will you put that bill on the floor? Will you pass a bill regarding the debt ceiling?
What type of bill do you want? We're never going to move a bill that just raises the debt
ceiling. Well, you want fiscal spending cuts.
I've been very clear with the president. I mean, think about what the Congressional Budget Office has said, right? We're going to pay in the next 10 years $10.5 trillion just in interest.
More than our defense budget.
Well, since 1940 till today, in 83 years, we've only spent $9 trillion on interest. We're about to be at the tipping point, 120% of GDP. We've never been here with the amount of debt that we had since World War II. So what I've told the president is, listen, we're bringing in more revenue than at any time in the history of America, but we're spending more than any time. So we've got to curve that. What we can do is we can build our economy, make it stronger. We can put in work requirements. We can cap how fast government grows.
So are you going to put this all in a bill?
Yes,
and try
I will.
To pass it
and
in
we
the
will
House.
Pass it.
When?
Unfortunately, I tried to
but
sit
when?
Down with the president, and the president
X-State
doesn't want to
ticking.
Communicate. We're out of session right now. When we come back, you might make some news.
Okay, we get back to session, maybe a timeline. Do you have any plans to talk to Wall Street? Because there are starting to grow some concerns.
Yeah, they should be concerned. Because I sat down with the president on February 1st, and the president never wants to meet. And what's interesting,
so is only your communications or just these letters?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about the debt ceiling. I want to make sure that we don't have conflict. And you've watched with the Democrats spending so much that brought us inflation.
You said you're going to talk to Wall Street.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Well, with Wall Street, I want to be very straight and forward with them. We can't continue down the path that we are right now. The CBO says if nothing happens, the trust funds of the highway, Medicare, and Social Security, they're going to get cut based upon the president. He's cutting those programs.
And the president doesn't want to cut them in his budget, though.
Well, the president is cutting them because what happens is they go broke in the next 2 years because he increased spending by $5.9 trillion. You can't afford it. And I don't want to do that. I want to save them. So we have to spend less money than we spent before. Let's put in work requirements. Let's cap the future of what our spending
is. So this potentially is going to be part of the bill. I also need to ask about the news. Former President Donald Trump, 34 felony charges. Mm-hmm. Republicans say this is a weak case that Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney, brought forward. And I was there at the court, actually. If it's a weak case, then why not just let the legal system work as it does for Americans every single day?
You know what's so interesting? You say Republicans say that. You know Democrats?
And some Democrats say
no,
that.
No, not just some, a lot. Cuomo said that. The New York Times. Everybody knows this is a weak case. Everybody knows this is political. But what's really happening here, if we sit back, remember, this is not an attorney general of a state. This is not even the DA of New York City. He's a borough DA who ran on a campaign that he was going to indict the president. He ran on a campaign getting money from Soros.
This is what's going to cause damage. You just watch a Republicans and Democrats sitting together talking about a serious issue. Then you watched a political person go out and try to sue a former president who's running again and bring politics into it. So what's going to happen? Are we going to find a small DA from a small county in a red state start to sue Biden when he leaves office? That's not America. America believes in the rule of law. And the way he's stretching this, everybody knows this is not a real case. So I think for the health of America, listen to the Republicans and Democrats alike and stop playing politics with our law.
And that was House Speaker Kevin McCarthy with Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern outside the Reagan Library in California.
And coming up,
a lot weighing on the global economy, Ed, but it's not all bad.
We'll hear all about it from Kristalina Georgieva, Managing Director of the IMF. You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, IMF and World Bank annual gatherings kick off in Washington this coming week.
And we will have special live coverage of the movers and shakers and the impact on financial markets right here on Bloomberg Radio.
Meanwhile, Bloomberg's Tom Keene had a chance to ask IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva about the economy.
And she tells him it's really a mixed picture right now.
Some of the fast-growing economies like China or South Korea are growing fast no more. But you would expect that there would be others to pick up the torch of strong growth. And this is not happening. What is holding growth back are three groups of factors. First, low productivity. We have been struggling with this phenomenon before the pandemic, and we continue to struggle with it. Second, it is fragmentation, the fact that the world economy does not enjoy the same impetus that comes from more trade.
Oh, you understand
more
it. We're going to spend this entire interview on trade fragmentation. Give me the third point right now.
Countries that we would expect to add to growth, frontier markets, low-income countries, are in particularly difficult place because they have been innocent bystanders of repetitive shocks, that COVID, Russia's invasion, the fact that the world economy as a whole is now less able to support the weakest members. Why? The peace dividend is gone.
Well, the peace, and we're through COVID, and it is a celebration of these meetings as we come beyond COVID, the assistance of you and other institutions in getting us beyond this pandemic. But you end your speech talking about the ropes that tie us together. The ropes between Washington and Beijing are frayed as you and I haven't seen from our youth. How does the IMF tie the ropes between Beijing and Washington back together?
Where we see an opportunity to do better is to identify very practically areas where cooperation is a must. Climate change cannot be fought by individual countries. The criticality of adjusting to more supply security at the lowest possible cost. Engaging on securing areas of the world that have become more fragile. It is in everybody's interest that we do not have more civil wars, more conflicts,
right, but in everybody's interest, and the tone here is China doesn't want to participate. Now, you spoke in your comments in your speech of the new practicality of the Premier of China. Can you report that there's a new practicality out of Beijing to help us with those ropes to tie together?
What I heard in our bilateral meeting and also publicly from Premier Li Qiang, are three important messages. China's commitment to continue to open its economy for private investors from all over the world. Second, China's commitment to play a constructive role in multilateral institutions, including the IMF. And third, China's commitment to support developing countries that are struggling with high debt levels. For many of them, China is the major, a major
creditor. What's so important here, and this goes to our Anne-Marie Horden's conversation with the Speaker of the House, but to take it away from the politics and go back to IMF 101, the Chinese don't want to participate in the normal and historic IMF restructuring process. They don't want to extend duration. They don't want to take a haircut and bring down the interest rate. They don't even want to write down some of the debts that they were directly or indirectly involved in.
Proof of the pudding is where? Mm-hmm. It is in the eating. So I can say we got reassurances from the Chinese leadership that they would play constructively.
Right.
Now we need to eat the cake. Now we need to see China delivering.
And that was IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva with Bloomberg's Tom Keen.
And that is it for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
This is Bloomberg. Stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.